All right, I'll get started. Thank you for coming. They'll file in here as soon as they hear me start. My name is Chris Amrine. I'm a soil chemist by training. I have some mineralogy training as well. I was got involved in the Salton Sea recently. The Salton Sea is the largest lake in California. It 960 square kilometers. It's 56 kilometers long and about 20 kilometers wide. It's located in Southern California. It lies below sea level, 70 meters below sea level, approximately 230 feet below sea level. It's about 240 kilometers from here. You can go visit it on a day trip quite easily. It's an interesting place. It's fed by water from the Colorado River. And what I'm showing you here is the Colorado River Basin. The Colorado River starts up here in Colorado, and it comes down through Lake Powell, cuts across through the Grand Canyon, and then it pours into Lake Mead. And then when it gets to the border between Arizona and California, the water from the Colorado River is brought over in two locations. It's brought over in a canal here just before it goes into Mexico. And it's used to irrigate 580,000 acres of land that produces vegetables for salad in the wintertime. To give you a comparison, this is the Mississippi River Basin. So for those of you from the central part of the United States can get an idea of the relative size difference. It's about one-fifth the area of the basin, but the flows in the Colorado River are substantially lower. It's a desert river. The last time I flew over the area in the space shuttle, I was able to get this picture. This is looking northeast, northwest. This is the islands. This is San Diego right here. This is San Diego Bay. This is what we call the Imperial Valley. It's about 500,000 acres of irrigated agriculture. This is Mexico, the Mexicali Valley. Water's brought over in this canal right here. This, the border is right about here and cuts across here. So this is the border with Mexico and California. This is the Colorado River down at this end here. It goes by the what's called the Palo Verde Valley. Just before it flows into Mexico, the water's brought over in a gravity-fed canal and is distributed over this area, producing agricultural vegetables that are distributed throughout the United States. To give you an idea of the relative size of the Salton Sea, its area and its depth, it's not particularly deep. Its deepest portion is about 15 meters. It's quite comparable in depth to the Aral Sea. Interestingly, the Aral Sea is drying up because of agriculture, whereas the Salton Sea has been created because of agriculture. Here's a bathymetry map showing the relative depths of the sea. It's sort of this peanut-shaped lake. The lake is relatively new. It's just 105 years old. It was formed at the turn of the century, 1905. Some farmers cut a channel to bring Colorado River water over. And in the spring of 1905, the diversion failed because of a flood stage on the river. And the full force of the Colorado River turned and flowed into what was then a dry sink, a low area called the Salton Sink. And it took them 15 months to repair the levee and get the river turned, flowing back south. And the sea filled up substantially. Then the sea began to dry up here. And then in 1924, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation came in and initiated a full-scale irrigation project, and the sea began to refill with drainage water and runoff water from the farms. And it remained fairly stable in elevation until the present time. And a few years ago, there was an agreement made to transfer some of the water from the Colorado, from the irrigation project to the coastal cities, which are in desperate need for more water. So it's projected that the Salton Sea is going to start to shrink. Currently, the sea is maintained 100% by, well, except for small amounts of rainfall, which are very minimal, excess irrigation water, which we call tailwater, water that runs off the surface of the end of the fields, subsurface drainage water to control salinity, and municipal wastewater. The largest volume comes from farms. It's essentially a farm runoff water. It's wastewater from agriculture. The valley produces $1 billion worth of hay, vegetables, grains, fruits, grapes, dates, on 230,000 hectares. The current inflow is 1.6 cubic kilometers per year, about 1.3 million acre feet. It's as much water as all of Southern California uses combined. It's the largest, this project is the largest user of water on the Colorado River. And with that is carrying 4 million tons of salt. The average inflow water quality is about 2,300 milligrams per liter total dissolved solids. And the current salinity of the sea, since it lies below sea level, the only outlet is evaporation. And the currently the sea is at 52,000 milligrams per liter of salt. So this is the salinity profile of the salinity graph showing how the salinity has been increasing over time. In the 1950s, the lake was at about seawater salinity and has been going up ever since. And currently it's at the point where fish are becoming scarce and the habitat is changing because of the loss of fish and the increase in salinity. And it's an important part of the Pacific Flyway. There's millions of birds come through the area every year and use the sea and stop and eat there and refresh themselves. The elevation has been quite variable because there is no control on the elevation except by evaporative loss and what flows in from the farms. And currently the sea is projected to start declining. And as the sea declines, it's going to expose sediments that are going to be 180 square kilometers of saline sediments. It's going to be twice as big as the current source of the Owens Dry Lake bed, which has been identified as the largest source of PM10 air pollution in the nation. So we're looking at a potential air pollution problem. The sea, they've tried to develop the shoreline of the sea, and as soon as they put in something, then the sea would rise and it would flood it out. And now the sea is beginning to shrink, leaving behind salt deposits that are picked up by the wind. And the Imperial Valley is the nation's leading asthma childhood area, so there's lots of concern about health issues associated with the drying of the sea. The sea is fed by contaminated agricultural wastewater, which has fertilizers and pesticides and pathogens and suspended solids and trace elements, selenium in particular. There's a state recreation area along the shore of the sea. At one time, the sea had more visitors than Yellowstone. And there's a lot of wildlife uses of the sea. So the lake is being currently fed by drain water and runoff water from irrigated agriculture. The reason you can buy salad in Christmas time is because it's grown in these fields right here. There's also problems with high water table, so there's subsurface drainage is required. This water is also discharged to the field, into the lake. And the water gets sewage flows from Mexicali, the city just across the border to the south, which flows downhill into the basin. It's been the New River, which has been identified as the most polluted river in America, so we have lots of firsts and greatest and biggest and worst. So the sea is contaminated. It has a very low oxygen in the summer. It produces high concentrations of hydrogen sulfide, and the fish are struggling to stay alive. And to make it interesting, there's a Native American tribe that owns quite a bit of land around the sea, and they're interested in improving the quality of the sea. So there's a number of birds that use the sea, and there's five endangered species that have been recognized at the sea, including one fish, a pupfish, desert pupfish, California brown pelican, and several other birds. This is a picture of the receding shoreline as the sea is beginning to dry up. And not all the birds that come and visit get away. So there's millions of birds here. 15,000 white pelicans have come to the sea. That thing's as big as a dog. You've never seen one. They're amazing. The sea is also hyper-eutrophic. It gets quite a bit of phosphorus and nitrogen loading from the farms. You can see there over 1,000 tons of pee are discharged to the sea and 14,000 tons of nitrogen. The sea is considered hyper-eutrophic. It has very high chlorophyll A levels. There's a lot of diatoms and single-cell algae in the sea. You can see, actually, from space, you can see these swirling green waters of the sea, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. The sea at one time, a few years ago, was recognized as the densest population of fish in the world of any lake. There was more fish per cubic meter in the lake than any other body of water in the world because of its incredibly high productivity, its high temperatures, and it's a. But in the summertime, the DOs can crash. You can get hydrogen sulfide being produced, and the fish-eating birds die. The current fish in the sea that we have there now, all the marine fish have disappeared. The only thing that's left are tilapia, which are this Nile perch, and they're found in huge numbers, but not all of them make it out of the sea either. So there's lots of issues associated with the sea that, you know, trying to decide what should we do and how should we improve its water quality. And the state is looking at spending upwards of $1 billion to do something about the changing ecosystem down there and to improve air quality and water quality. One of the things that I've been working on is water quality issues, and associated with that has been the interest in mineral precipitation in the sea. I'll get to the topic that I'm supposed to be talking about here in a few seconds. One of the things that we're very interested in the West is how irrigated agriculture impacts the carbon cycle and burial of carbon via calcite precipitation in irrigated projects. So the sea is precipitating huge amounts of calcium carbonate, and I'll talk about how we've measured that and how we've quantified that. Also, another interesting phenomenon that I'm going to present is the impact of sulfate reduction on carbonate precipitation. The most recent work I've been doing has to do with selenium. There's moderately high levels of selenium in the Colorado River, and they, through evapoconcentration, the concentrations at the seashore are borderline toxic for wild waterfowl. So how does the sea vary from ocean water? Well, you can see there's a bit more calcium, about 2.5 times more calcium than ocean water. The magnesium's about the same. The sodium's a bit higher because the salinity's a bit higher. The bicarbonate's about, not quite double. But the most dramatic difference here is that the sulfate concentration is well over 4 times, almost 5 times, the concentration of ocean water. And that has a huge impact on the biogeochemistry that takes place in the ocean, in the sea. So we've been looking at how the sea is going to change over time. The sea is going to get, the elevation of the sea is going to go down as we put less water in. The surface area of the sea is going to become smaller, exposing more bare shore, and the salinity is going to rise, and it could rise quite rapidly depending upon how much water is diverted away from going into the lake and diverted to the coastal cities. It's predicted that the sea is going to be about this size in about 40 years, and we're looking at a lot of bare shore all around the sea that could potentially be a source of dust. And there is some issues of building fish ponds or habitat to keep the fish-eating birds, because this portion of the sea will become hypersaline and will not support fish. So there's lots of minerals that are forming in the sea. The sea has been oversaturated with respect to calcite since its formation. Gypsum began precipitating, we believe, about 1988 in the sea. And we're also seeing extensive amounts of iron sulfide minerals, pyrite, greggite, and amorphous iron, FES. We did a survey of the sediments of the sea. We motored around for several days collecting mud. And you can see that the calcium carbonate has an average concentration in the sediments of 24%, but there's very high concentrations. The sediments are 50% calcium carbonate in the northern end of the sea. What's interesting is these high calcite concentrations that we find in the sediments are also associated with the organic carbon. So the algal production tends to be moved to the northern basin here because of the prevailing winds. The organic carbon settles to the bottom and is fueling calcite precipitation, and I'll explain how that happens in a second. We also find some gypsum in the sediments, but not nearly as much gypsum as we'd predict based on mass balances. If you look at the long-term records of the chemistry of the sea and the inflow waters and how much calcium's been going in, and chloride and sodium and sulfate and bicarbonate, we would predict about 860,000 tons, metric tons of calcite should be precipitating in the sea, which would be about 22% of the total salt flowing in. But the problem with this calculation is that calcite precipitation is actually bicarbonate limited in the lake. And theoretically, only 330,000 tons of calcium carbonate can precipitate because there's a shortage of alkalinity. So there's one of two things is wrong. Either there's extensive gypsum precipitation, far more than we're finding in the sediments, or there's an additional source of alkalinity. And this turns out to be the case. And the source of the alkalinity, or bicarbonate, is sulfate reduction. So here's the chemistry that's causing the formation of calcite in the sea. And it's quite extensive. More than half of the calcite that forms in the sea is occurring because of this reaction here, where we have primary productivity producing organic carbon, and the high sulfate concentrations and as this algae settles to the bottom, there's anaerobic conditions in the bottom fueling sulfate reduction, and hydrogen sulfide gas is being produced. And this generates bicarbonate, which then precipitates calcite. And in fact, the bottom waters of the sea, the pore waters of the sediment, for example, are actually undersaturated with respect to gypsum, whereas the Salton Sea itself is oversaturated with respect to both calcite and gypsum. So any gypsum that actually forms in the lake, if it falls into the bottom waters or into the lower reaches of the sea, actually dissolves. So you can see that the difference in sulfate here between the Salton Sea and the pore water, this loss of sulfate is due to sulfate reduction. So we estimated the amount of hydrogen sulfide that the lake is producing, and it works out using some flux measurements of hydrogen sulfide coming out of the sediments, 75,000 metric tons of hydrogen sulfide per year. To give you a reference on how much that is all the industrial sources in California that are licensed to discharge H2S to the atmosphere amount to 5,000 tons. So this is a huge source of hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is incredibly toxic. Not all this hydrogen sulfide escapes the lake, though, luckily. Most of it is reoxidized in the water column as it percolates back up through to the surface. So using this amount of hydrogen sulfide being produced, we generate enough bicarbonate via this reaction to almost meet the total tonnage of calcium carbonate that's precipitating. So we are still getting some gypsum. The other interesting thing that's forming in the sea, because of all these anaerobic conditions in the lower reaches, is we're actually seeing about 7,000 tons of iron sulfide minerals forming. And the sediments, here's the distribution of these iron sulfide minerals in the sediments. About half of the sediment by weight is pyrite. And the source of the iron is the clay minerals that are washing off of the fields. I showed you that picture of the muddy tailwater. This becomes the source of the iron that's forming these pyrite. I've got pictures of pyrite here from the sediments. These are about 5 microns in diameter, and they're made up of these individual framboids of pyrite. And if you do an XPS on them, you can see that they're pure iron sulfide, and they are in fact pyrite. What's interesting is that the pyrite is found in the lower reaches of the lake, these lower basins. This is the source. Most of the inflow comes from these two rivers, the Alamo River and the New River. These is the two largest sources of inflow. This is the base, this is the area where the intensive agriculture is, and all the muddy water that's flowing in. The source of the reducible iron is coming in on these waters down here. So the pyrite's in the lower basin. The northern basin has the calcite in it. Well, how are we doing here? Oh, we're in good shape. So when you fly over this lake in the summertime, or in this late fall here, this was a few years ago, California was burning up. You might have seen this on the news, and there was lots of pictures being taken of the fires all over Southern California, and I got all excited because I saw this green water in the lake. And you can see here's the border with Mexico. This is the irrigated agriculture here of the Imperial Valley. It all lies below sea level. This is the northern basin up here. It's called the Coachella Valley. This is where Palm Springs is. And golf courses, there's 120 golf courses in this northern basin up here. 200 of the Fortune 500 CEOs have homes or second homes in this valley right here. It's a wintertime fun in the sun for golfers. So if you play golf, you've probably seen or heard about this area. And just down 40 miles away is the largest lake in California burping out hydrogen sulfide gas. So there is some concern about, there is a lot of interest in trying to correct the problem of the eutrophic conditions and the hydrogen sulfide being produced in this lake. But we've learned something about these green patterns that appear in the lake. They're not algae, which kind of surprised us all. If you go and you collect water from this darker area here, and you collect water from this green area, what you find is you find that this green water, this bright green water, is actually green because it's full of gypsum crystals. It's actually reflecting on these 50 micron gypsum crystals that are forming due to an upwelling of hydrogen sulfide from the bottom water. You get a mixing event late in the season, like in September and October, and this hydrogen sulfide that's collected in the bottom water mixes into the surface water, which is oxygenated. It's rapidly oxidized to sulfate, and you get a flash gypsum precipitation that occurs in the surface water. It also takes all the oxygen out of the water. The water's full of hydrogen sulfide. There's actually no chlorophyll in this green water. There's no algae in there. But there is a lot of floating dead fish because of the toxicity of the hydrogen sulfide. If you sample this blue water, which it's blue if you're up close, it's high in oxygen. There's no gypsum. It's actually full of chlorophyll, and you can catch fish in this green, in this darker colored water. So we get these sulfide eruptions, and they occur after a wind event. You get this upwelling of hydrogen sulfide, and you get this flash precipitation of gypsum. But these little crystals settle back down to the bottom, and then they redissolve because the bottom waters are anaerobic and they're undersaturated with respect to gypsum. So we have this real interesting gypsum cycle going on in the lake that we really didn't anticipate at all. So here's a picture of the green water, blue water. You can see this is actually green because of these microscopic gypsum crystals that settle out of the water after an event. And then in the foreground here is the non-gypsiferous water. And that gives you a sense of scale looking across the lake there. It's about 15 miles across. It's in a desert valley, lies below sea level. I think that's my last slide. No, I got one more. So we're precipitating about 700,000 tons of calcite per year, about 100,000 tons of gypsum. The gypsum that forms in the shallow water tends not to dissolve because the shallow water doesn't get anaerobic enough to redissolve it. We're finding about 75,000 tons of hydrogen sulfide, 7,000 tons of pyrite. About 20% of the total salt load that's going into the lake is precipitating. And just for reference, to sort of summarize what this all means, there was one study that looked at how much calcite was precipitating in the irrigation project itself, and it was predicted to be about 1 million tons. That was a little bit of an old work. Newer studies now suggest that, in fact, there is very little calcite precipitating in the irrigation project, and all of the calcium burial is actually taking place downstream of the irrigation project. It's not really, the soils are being sufficiently leached that they're keeping the calcite formation. It's a fairly slow reaction in the irrigated project because of the high CO2 in the root zone. So we're at least precipitating as much calcite in the lake as we are in the irrigation project. And I think when you look at sort of the impact of irrigated agriculture on the carbon cycle, you also have to look at downstream receiving waters. And in this case, we have a closed inland basin that's taking all the water from irrigation. So that's my last slide, and I'll take any questions.
Let's thank Chris. Any questions, Chris? Chris, you probably put it out there, but what's the pH of the lake? Is it stable?
Yeah, the pH is about 7. It's difficult to measure the pH of the lake because of the high sodium. There's a sodium interference with the electrode, okay? But it's in the mid-7s. I'll say 7.6 is what we measure with the pH electrode, although I suspect that's a problem, not exactly correct. So it'll never become a high pH soda lake like Mona Lake, which is another big lake we have in California. That's pH 9.2 because it's dominated by sodium bicarbonate. This lake will never get to be like that. It's a sodium sulfate lake. Well, sodium chloride, sodium sulfate lake. Right. We're getting these mixed sulfate minerals and chloride minerals. Okay, so nisquehonite and no, not nis, morabilite.
Okay.
The evaporites. Yeah. So we see sort of the classic evaporite minerals forming around the perimeter.
And
yeah, the pHs are not below 7 anywhere. Anywhere, okay? Nothing's below 7.
Yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned that green color is due to gypsum receptors. You mentioned that green color for the water receptor for the sea.
Yes.
What's the reason why you use gypsum rather than water for the
sea? Oh, that's interesting. If you sample this water, it's full of these microscopic gypsum crystals. They range in size from 10 micron to 50 micron, and they're perfectly formed, and they're very reflective. They're bright, and from space you can actually see the reflectance that's taking place off of these gypsum crystals from the water. It makes that water that bright blue green. We measured, and I'm trying to remember the number. 150 crystals per milliliter. Okay, so it's quite bright. I mean, the water is filled with these little microscopic gypsum crystals, which don't persist. If they settle to the bottom of the lake, then they redissolve because the bottom waters are, there's enough sulfate reduction in the bottom waters to redissolve that gypsum that forms. Okay, does that make sense? It's just due to scattering, yes. Yeah.
How much of the calcite is magnesium calcite?
We measured the magnesium content of the calcite, and it's not particularly high. I think it's about 4% magnesium substitution into the calcite. I have a paper on that.
How is calcite measured? Just with manometric methods.
Yeah, so pressure. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.